Sehen Sie ungefähr 8 bis 10 Seiten an Funktionen, die er schon ausgeübt hat und Funktionen, die er wahrgenommen hat. Einige wenige, die er ausübt, ist zum Beispiel Chairman und Board Member von Creative Commons. Er ist auch Board Member von Witness, einer Organisation, die sich der Dokumentation insbesondere von Menschenrechtsverletzungen widmet, das also in unserem Zusammenhang sehr wesentlich ist. Und er hat zahlreiche Funktionen in japanischen Regierungskomitees und ähnliches. Also, ich habe vorher kurz gesagt, er hat begonnen als Demonstrant auf der Straße mit dem Megafon und ist dann, wie das halt so passiert, in diversen Regierungskomitees gelandet. Das ist einer der kreativsten und bedeutendsten Internetaktivisten. Ich glaube, viel mehr kann man dazu gar nicht sagen. Und auch Investor in vielen Dingen. Und ich freue mich, ja, und begonnen hat er, wie viele andere auch, mit einem Server in seinem Badezimmer, der erste Internetzugangspunkt, der kommerzielle Internetzugangspunkt Japan war in seinem Badezimmer installiert. Sie können sich selbst auf die Fotos anschauen. Ich freue mich besonders, Mr. Junichi Ito, to look forward to your speech.
Thank you very much. So, first of all, I was instructed that I didn't have to talk all about privacy. So I would like to just start off by mentioning that I basically agree with everything that Victor said. And in the last question and answer that he gave, Victor mentioned the importance of the market. And one of the things that I have been working on, you mentioned that I started out with a megaphone, I'm protesting legislation and technical things in Japan. And then I started working inside the government to try very hard to change legislation and to enact protections about privacy. But very quickly I reached limits of what I felt we need to continue to do legislation, but that wasn't enough. And more you find out that what you need is you need to rely on the market. So legislation needs to have make market sense. But in addition to just market sense, more and more of the internet and what happens on the internet is governed by the social norms of this sort of new generation of internet users. And so, while I was thinking about what to talk about today, as a venture capitalist, one of the things that I focus on very much is to try to understand the behavior of the new generation of people who use the internet, because it's a completely different behavior than my behavior and than your behavior. And so as an investor, I have to look at the new behavior, predict where it's going, and invest in change. And so in English we use the word contrarian, which is against the way that we currently go. So my successful investments are investments that are not obvious, that older generation people can't even imagine, but which become suddenly huge. But I think that we have a similar issue or problem, where most of the people, at least in Japan, and I assume the rest of the world, most of the people who are making the laws passing the judgments aren't from that generation, who are currently making the rules on the internet, who are currently promoting the products on the internet. So I'm going to focus a little bit on two things. One is the way that this new generation thinks and the difference, and also maybe a way that we can look at and understand how to interact with this new generation. And I apologize because I don't have written remarks, and translators are going to have a difficult time, especially since most of what I'm going to talk about is quite crazy. So first of all, there is a word called the creative class, which Richard Florida uses to describe a kind of artistic creative class that helps the development of new. It's an urban sort of discussion word, and I think Ars Electronica is a very good example of the creative class rejuvenating the city of Linz by bringing artists and creative people together. On the internet, I think that there can be another use of this word, which is, I think there's a new generation of young people who can't remember not having the internet, who are completely different than me or you. And I try to think like they do, but I can't completely, but I can observe them and talk to them. And they are so different from the past generation that they're more similar to each other globally than they are to their parents inside of the same countries. So you look at an example like a social networking system on Google called Orkut. It's very popular in the United States and in Brazil and in Iran. And these people play the same software, they enjoy many of the same things. And the similarity between the youth culture in Iran and Brazil and the United States is more similar than the parents' culture in Iran and the parents' culture in Brazil and the parents' culture in the United States. And I think that this kind of creative generation is creating what I would call a gap, a very large gap between the older generation and the new generation. I think the new generation, anthropologically, it's quite interesting because the new generation understands this technology better than their parents. We all know this, but this is actually a new thing. I think historically it's very difficult to point out a time in history where the children knew more about the technology that was driving society than the parents did. And I think that when we think about that, we have to think about, well, they have a lot of power, and we need to kind of figure out the relationship between those in power, which are the kids, and those who are typically in power, which is the judges and the government. And this relationship is a very interesting relationship. I'm also on the board of ICANN, which is the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. And what we do, it's an international body, but it's not an intergovernmental body. It's a multi-stakeholder organization. And what we do is we decide how IP addresses and domain names are allocated. So it's quite an important project from a global perspective. But very interesting point is the people who run these domain name servers, which are whenever you type in a domain name, it goes and looks up. The people who run these servers are mostly volunteer. They're mostly academic. And they are not following any laws. So the IP addresses, these are... It's basically a bottom-up consensus process that doesn't always work. But what's important is that you can't force any of these people to do anything. We are always having long conversations, and people volunteer, and voluntarily, people comply with the code of the internet. And the internet is a working anarchy. We come up with rules, but the only enforcement we have is consensus. The only way we can get anyone, the Arab League, or India, or China, the only way we can get them to agree to follow our rules is to say, you were there, you discussed it, you agreed. So it's a social pact. We have no legal authority over the internet, but the internet runs. And so one of the other things that I would like to point out is historically, I'm an internet entrepreneur. So I used to work in television and mainstream media, but the internet is completely different. It's out of control. You trust your neighbors. You follow basic rules and practices and ethics, and it sort of runs. And it's amazing to me because I think a lot of people who use the internet for business don't realize that any dozens of people can turn the internet off if they felt like it. But they don't, because they have ethics, they have professionalism, and they have a consensus process. And what's interesting is you can't force these people, because it's a global society of people in various walks of life. There's no one jurisdiction, for instance, that covers it. And there's no UN on top of it. So anyway, I just want to pose that because we are already living on top of an infrastructure that has no really legitimate legal foundation. And many of the things that are coming also exhibit this problem. So first of all, I want to talk about this gap. So in 2004, in the American Super Bowl, which is the most expensive advertising space, I don't know if you remember, but back then, the American Record Associations were catching teenagers who were illegally copying music and arresting them. So Pepsi and Apple took these kids who were arrested and made a television commercial to promote this iTunes where they were giving away free music. So this is a video of that. The record companies got it wrong. They thought, here's a new activity, a new behavior by young people. It ruins our business. It's illegal. Let's arrest them. And then they started punishing their customers. But Apple and iTunes came out and said, wait, this is a new behavior. This is the new way that kids are enjoying music. They share music. They want to talk about music. And they don't need CDs. And what they did was, they said, okay, well, let's market to this audience, let's communicate with this audience, and let's create a product, as Victor mentioned in his comments, that makes business sense, makes it cheaper to be legal than to be illegal, to make the experience of being legal better than being illegal. So the reaction immediately by the establishment when the kids were illegally downloading music was, they're breaking the law, we must punish them, they're criminals. And in the US they even called them terrorists. But then smart marketing people like Pepsi, they quickly said, okay, no, we make a product for these people. We'll make a campaign for these people and turn them into our customers. And the success of Apple and iTunes shows that that vision of looking for a behavior change and trying to adapt themselves to the behavior change rather than trying to ban and prohibit the behavior change is generally more successful. So I want to talk about some key points of this behavior changes that may be kind of a new way of thinking about that I think young kids are doing. One is the word context, and this has a lot of context in privacy discussion as well, but context is, if you think about content as information, which is somewhat static, like a thing, so a CD or a dictionary, this is content, and it's generally the same price, it doesn't depreciate in value over time very much. It can be shipped around in trucks. It doesn't matter to whom, when, it doesn't have much context, it's quite important, same importance. And then you look at the consumption of media by young people went from books and CDs to video games, at least in Japan, which was more interactive, had more context, you needed to be able to play the game and it had different value for different people. And then it went to karaoke, I'm sure you know karaoke, and karaoke was much more about, it wasn't whether they were good or not, it was they were your friends. So while it was based on a platform of commercial content, most of the value of karaoke was the songs that people, the users, were generating on top of. And now, even in the West, we have this SMS and texting and things like that. And the young kids now in Japan spend most of their money reading each other's texts. But if you examine the inside of the text, there is no content. I woke up, I went to sleep, I'm hungry, I like you, I don't like you. And it's not even as content from a privacy perspective. Each piece doesn't have that much. You know, maybe some of the photos, but generally, what it is, it's when, who, where, it's the context that provides everything. And I think that more and more, what you find is that the value is, see, what internet and mobile has done is it has provided us the ability to receive information from anyone, anywhere, anytime. This is the big difference. This is what's changed from mainstream media, because mainstream media was about manufacturing and distribution of information as if it were a thing, and all consumers had to be treated somewhat similarly. They had different markets, but they were all producers and consumers. But now with the internet, everyone communicates with everyone else, and it's the context which has the value. And similarly, from a privacy perspective, I think it's less and less about really specific data, and more about who is talking to who, when, what do the social networks look like. In the intelligence community, they call this signal intelligence, or SIGINT, which is analyzing the patterns of calls. There's a very interesting software package that was designed in the United States where they can look at the telephone logs, not the contents, but just the calls, to very quickly see, oh, this is where the organized crime is, here's a network of drug dealers. They can tell just by looking at the shape of the network. And this is, again, context instead of content. And so I think we need to kind of start to retune ourselves to what is it like when you're always on. I'm sure most of you are not like this, but young kids, a lot of Japanese kids, always have their phone. They can text without looking in their pocket. They can't turn it off. It's on all night. And they're always connected. And there's a word that we use called co-presence. And co-presence is basically, I share my presence with you, which means that when I go to sleep, when I wake up, when I'm sick, I always tell you. So the average Japanese young person knows the presence is co-present with between 5 and 10 people. So about 5 and 10 people, they know exactly what those people are doing, awake, asleep, on their way. So even when they go out for the evening, they just go out. They don't make plans. And then they say, oh yeah, okay, let's meet up here. They decide where to go and what to do based on the presence of the other people. Because you don't have to plan if you know what each person is doing and thinking. Oh yeah, John mentioned he wanted Chinese food today, but he's over in Shibuya. I'm gonna head sort of in that direction. Maybe I can meet up with Sarah. You know, they're together. So even though they're physically separate, it never brings them together. And this co-presence is a new kind of content. It's actually a kind of context. And this is what the telephone companies in Japan make $10 billion a year, is connecting these kids together so they can have co-presence. Not so that they can sing opera to each other or work on dissertations with each other. They're sitting around, sharing their presence, and going out and drinking and singing karaoke. So this is one kind of value. And now when you think about the fact that this is global, I don't think that we've really thought about how this is regulated. There's a lot of consumer products now coming out to support the sharing of co-presence, but it's something new, and I think we need to think about it. I'll give some more examples. The other one is remix. So remix culture, before, you know, if you wanted to take a video and you wanted to remix it, it required a lot of technology, a lot of money, and a lot of skill. But the cost of remixing has gone down so much that it's become a kind of standard thing that people do with content. And one very important thing is that text, ever since we had typewriters and word processors, we've remixed text. So I'll use a different, maybe there's a different way to explain it. If I write a book and you take a section of the book and you criticize me, and you call me stupid, and, you know, fascist, or whatever, I may not like it, but I can't prevent you from doing that. If I write a dissertation, you can remix that dissertation and give me credit and point at me and argue with me. Because if you didn't allow that, we wouldn't have a deliberative democracy. We wouldn't have the ability to have a competition of ideas. One of the problems right now is that young people, if you look at the popularity of YouTube and music, they now have a different language in addition to text. And they remix sounds and videos. But they don't have the freedoms that we do that we have with text. It's much more regulated, and it's a very different kind of world. So I'll describe that a little bit more. But remix, I think, is in multimedia on the internet is an important thing that we need to think about. And sharing is also, now when you go to Hollywood, everybody says, share to mean stealing, right? But it's not the same thing. There is a basic fundamental behavior that kids are doing on the internet, which is they share things with each other. It's this core of the open source movement. It's a fundamentally different way, because now we can ship. So for instance, if you look at the way that music sharing works, I go into a chat room and somebody says, I just found this great artist. Oh, can I listen to it? Okay, here's a link. And oh, that's neat. That reminds me of a Romanian artist, blah, blah, blah. Oh, here's an article. Yeah, let me send you a picture I took when I was there. And in a conversation in a chat room, people are sharing pictures and sounds. But you have to imagine that this is so much more sort of intellectually rigorous than dinner conversation where you say, oh yeah, there is such a song. Oh, that's interesting. You know, and I once read an article that, but I can't remember where, that said something about some Eastern European country. Yeah, maybe there was one like that. That's the typical dinner conversation that we have when we're kind of drunk on wine and trying to talk about some music that we read about. On the internet, the kids are connecting in each other and they're showing, and of course it's stealing. But if you think about it from a cultural perspective, they are so much more literate. If you look at the media consumption of young kids, they're now reading media from all over the world. So I have an argument with somebody on a chat room about American Republican politics. You know. So suddenly people are leaking things from Indian newspapers about the Republicans outsourcing to India, the politics, so there's pictures of George Bush coming in. And this is amazing. And this is very important for what I think is increasing global dialogue among people, which I think is an important part of human rights. Because I believe that as we move into the 21st century, you know, including this Declaration of Human Rights, a fundamental pillar of democracy is going to be the ability to speak to each other, to have voice. I think in the past, a lot of our struggle was solved through physical violence, through destruction. But as we know, the war on terror that the Americans are waging happens just as much in the media and in the ability to speak as it does in the physical world. And so I think that the internet is one of the important fundamental pillars that we have to protect in terms of freedom and open society in the next generation. And so, and sharing is another word for the ability to communicate with each other without encumbrance. Another important part, which relates to the lowering of the costs, is an amateur. So I think if I'm not a linguist, so I don't know for sure, but I think the Latin root is like amator, or it comes from the lovers, or to do it for the love of it, right? And so ever since the mass media and professional producers were created, for some reason when you say amateur, it means not so good. And for some reason professional, oh, you look like a professional, or that's professional quality, makes it sound better. But I think a long time ago, that wasn't necessarily true. And I think as we get into the information age, it's becoming less and less true, at least all of the time. So an example is Linux, which is the open source operating system. I talk to a lot of people who work on Linux. They don't work on Linux because they can't get a job at Microsoft. They work at Linux because they love Linux. They love open source. They love software. And I think what's very important to understand is that the reason we had to have professionals in many cases was the cost of the education, the cost of the manufacture, and the cost of the distribution of information required a professional corporate structure that allowed people to make television shows and motion pictures. You had to have a whole financing and manufacturing distribution system that required professionals. But now, with computers and the internet, somebody who isn't a completely talented, dexterous piano player can still make music on a computer. Even if you don't have full training, maybe if you don't have you don't have to have a multi-million dollar studio to make motion pictures anymore. The bar for creating and distributing and participating in the process of creativity has gone down. It's bad because there's also a lot of noise, but it's good because people, so I imagine many of you are judges. Many of you may be talented musicians as well, and you made a choice somewhere along your life to say, I'm going to become a judge or a lawyer. But maybe on the weekends, when you have free time, if you have any free time, maybe you get inspired to do something different. And in fact, what's interesting is the amateurs can think kind of different because many professionals are stuck in a kind of set pattern. So television, for example, they have formats. And news reporters have to follow the format. So it's interesting that amateur videographers on the internet are actually being much more creative as amateur videographers than the professionals. And so, and Ars Electronica, I think, is very important in that it brings the artists into the process of sort of pushing against the professionals. I think the professionals will never go away. they're very important. But I think the importance of the amateur is becoming huge. And I think there's almost kind of an amateur revolution. And one of the problems, Victor mentioned this about digital rights management, is that the ability for professionals to be represented in government conversation and in legislation is much higher. The amateurs are not very good. So right now, I don't know about Europe, but in the United States, the current copyright law, Digital Millennium Copyright Act, makes it illegal to circumvent copyright technology. So for instance, if I have some piece of content and Christine wants to use my piece of content on her show, and I have a DVD, she has my DVD. If she uses some Linux software to take the picture out of the DVD and broadcast it on ORF, she has broken the US Millennium Copyright Act because she has circumvented the technology. So even though the two ends are okay with the copyright, because the technology is protecting those copyright holders that don't want to share, that transaction becomes illegal. And so the risk that we have is, in order to protect the financial interests of less than 1% of the content on the internet, we're creating an infrastructure of law and technology that makes it very difficult for the amateurs. And so I think that one of the things we need to continuously think about is, how do we represent the amateur in this conversation that we're having about privacy and legislation? Another kind of simple thing, which is quite interesting, and I'm not going to go into this in detail, but something that we need to think about, is the notion of happiness. Victor mentioned the market, and I think that in post-industrial neoclassic economics, much of our models, it depends on this notion that everyone is working for more money, and the more money you have, the happier you are. And it's a kind of desire and pleasure-based reward system, and everyone works very hard to make more money. This is kind of some of the ethics of what I think is part of the older professional generation. One of the things that's interesting about the amateurs is they're not driven so much by money. And their notion of happiness isn't necessarily as much of the desire-driven happiness as a kind of more, I would say, Buddhist happiness. Because the communities, like Wikipedia, for example, is an interesting community. And I'll talk about it a little bit more. They don't even want attribution. They're anonymous, but they participate. And I know people who spend the whole day fixing spelling. Or somebody else who goes around and just, you know, changes formats. And it's like a gardener. It's like if you went outside today and started picking up the weeds, it makes you feel happy. It's not market-driven. It's not financial. It's not commercial. It's not rational. But it's what drives the behavior of many, many people on the internet. Many of them have a lot of power. In fact, I would say that people who run the most important servers on the internet, the root servers, most of them are not doing anything for financial reasons. It's because they're part of a community and they're doing it to participate in this community. And it's actually this participation in the community that drives them to follow their rules, follow the norms, and act. And I think that unless you understand that, often what we do is we try to legislate, we try to strike fear, like the kids with the music. The record industry tried to scare them into obedience. And iTunes is now trying to pay them into obedience. But I think there's another level, which is this kind of community that these young people participate in, that are creating the rules that they will follow because they want to participate in this community. And so one example I'll give, there's a process called fan subbing, which is subtitling videos. So a lot of Japanese, so this is hard to see, but this is a BitTorrent file download site. And Naruto is one of the most popular Japanese cartoons. This is actually an old site because this no longer exists. But if you look, it says French, Hebrew, Portuguese. So those are communities of fans who, first of all, somebody takes the television show and uploads it that day. And then a whole community of fans in each language will translate. And they put the subtitles on and they post it. Okay. And in Hollywood they say these are pirates. Every time they post and somebody downloads, we lose $50. So this year we lost billions of dollars. And they calculate this activity as a net loss on their earnings because it's stealing. Right? But I would say that they're not lost sales, they're gained fans. Because this is, before Naruto came out in English, if you went to Amazon and you searched for Naruto, it said, enter your email address so we can tell you when you get the DVD. And the community was lobbying to get the official version out in that language. And in fact, most of these fan sub communities have a rule that if the DVD comes out in their language, say the Austrian community, if it comes out in Austrian, that site of illegal downloads goes away. And they stop subtitling. They have huge respect for the artists and the authors. And they're only doing the subtitling because they are so excited by this show. They want to share it with their friends who can't speak the language. And what's happening is many of the companies and legislatures and discussions that we have about this, we call them pirates. Because in the past, when you had to have physical videos, there was a lot of piracy involved because you created a business of, you had to create a business in order to do the distribution. But now that the internet makes the transaction cost zero, there's no business involved, there's no money involved. And in fact, everyone, not everyone, most of the people who are involved in these are involved because they love it, not because they're making any money about it. And the behavior is very, very different. And the interesting thing is the marketing people inside of these companies understand this. So secretly they get copies, but they do it illegally. And when the lawyers in these companies find out, the lawyers going to shut down the site and arrest these kids. So there's a huge, weird kind of conflict going on where the law makes this kind of activity very difficult. So this is a logo of Wikipedia, and I think everyone knows it, but I'll describe it briefly. So for instance, this is basically an encyclopedia that anyone can edit. And so this is an Islam article, and anyone can go in and edit it. And the interesting thing is that it's actually quite a good article. And there are people who argue many, many things, but it's one key point about Wikipedia is it's easier to delete somebody's comment than to create a negative comment. And so people delete and delete and delete, and they argue until the one comment that survives everyone's point of view, that's the neutral point of view, is the one that remains. And so if you look at, this is an IBM study of this Wikipedia Islam article. And each color is a different user. And as you can see, some people add comments, and then sometimes it gets reorganized, and sometimes it gets deleted. What's interesting is that deletion is a vandalism. But if you look at this study was several years ago, but the average mean time for an article to get deleted before it was fixed. So the average mean time of vandalism was about 5 minutes. Now it's about 3 minutes. And the amazing thing is that even though you can go in and vandalize it, it heals itself in about 3 to 5 minutes. And it's basically a living thing. So yes, you can compare it with Encyclopedia Britannica and other things, but this is actually a community of people. And this, again, has a huge gap, because I think that as academics, they don't like to cite Wikipedia because it's always changing, and it may be wrong when somebody looks at it. But from a young person's perspective, there's a conversation, there's people, you can talk to them, you can follow links, it reacts, you know. And you don't just read it, everyone writes to it, right? And so this is a very different kind of authority. And this is an authority about facts that survive scrutiny, rather than facts that came from experts. And for instance, a very interesting point is the Wikipedia expert on British history is 15-year-old American kid. And by consensus, he's the expert because he knows more than everyone else. Even academics agree that in certain areas he knows more than everyone else. And it's a very meritocracy-based system. It doesn't always work, but usually it works. Since running out of time, I'm going to skip ahead. But so remix, I'll just show a video of a remix. This is a Japanese. This was on YouTube for a little while. It keeps getting taken down. And the reason I'm showing this right now is that a lot of people hate it, right? And most people would think, oh, this is crude and rude. The problem is that the kids who are making this is their new style. And this is a new way of communicating for them. And we can resist it by saying, this is copyright, this is remix, but it's pushing it underground. Now this whole culture of remixing, this is a remixing a 60s Japanese musician that all the older generation loves, with American rap singer Fatboy Slim, and it had very interesting. interesting repercussions. But I'll show this last one. But it can also become political. This is a Swedish group.
There's only you.
On the internet, they would pay. maybe we can charge them. You know? And so what they're doing is they've now got so much more rights on the internet. They're now trying to export those rights to the real world. And I think that, you know, large companies obviously follow a very commercial business-like process. But I think we need to be careful about thinking about increasing the right to copyright. And so there's a general discussion about the importance of copyright. But finally,
I want to talk about, from an amateur's perspective. So copyright, most copyright we have based on the convention is all rights are reserved. You have to ask permission before you can do anything. And then there are the people, the hackers, who say, there's no, we don't want copyright. Everything should be free. We'll take it away even if you don't want us to. And we're trying to build something in between, saying most people would like to give some rights, maybe not all rights. And so what we're saying is that the amateur, for instance, is an amateur photographer, I don't mind you using my photograph as long as you give me attribution. And I don't want you to have to ask permission for you to do that. So what we've tried to do is create a methodology for allowing people to mark their works with permissions they would like to grant, so that people don't have to ask permission, to encourage sharing. And so basically it's three pieces.
I want attribution. You can't use it for commercial purposes, and you cannot create derivative rights. So this would be connected to your content. And then we have for lawyers and judges, we have another part, which is the legal code. We have this in 38 jurisdictions, ported to the local language that involves all the local things. And we're in 80 countries, and so every year we're launching new licenses that are normalized to the local law. And most countries we have fairly rigorous process. For instance, Korea is the federal judges, Korea court. In Austria, we have excellent license as well. And then we have a machine readable code. So this, Google and Yahoo can now read this code. So when you search for links, you can say, I want pictures that I can use for commercial use on my television show. And it will search the license, find the correct license, and use it. So we're trying, as I was saying before, on the one hand, digital rights management is making the internet unfriendly for the amateur. We're trying to create a new vehicle to make it more friendly for amateurs, or even some professionals. And I guess I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip the three people section. So, well, thank you very much.